Hello and welcome to the Parent Guide to GCSE, Parent Guide to Education podcast. At last, finally, we have got a SENDco coming to join us to talk to us all things SEND, basically. And she has got a load. Well, we gave her a load of questions that we came up with. But I think better still, we've had loads of members, loads of people from Facebook saying, oh, while she's on, could you please pitch this question? So without any further ado, hello, Kate. Thank you very, very much for joining us. We're always desperate to get a SENDco on, so you are a saviour. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We have had loads of questions from members, from members and from just people in general. So, but we're going to start off with a few kind of like generalised questions, I guess. Who's going first?
Go for it.
Okay, I've got the thing in front of me. Right. In terms of SEN issues, we think, we read about, are on the rise. Is mm-hmm. that true? And if so, what are the reasons for that?
I think that, yeah, in terms of SEND and understanding around SEND and identification of SEND, I think there is a lot of, there's been an increase, significant increase, actually, over the last few years in pupils that are being identified as SEND. So if you look at England on its own, there's like 1.5 million pupils currently identified as having requiring SEND support or EHCP within the classroom. And that's up from, I think it's around about 80,000, 90,000 from last year. So there, you can see that there is definitely an increase in the percentage of SEND that's being identified by schools year on year. And this is a trend that we're seeing like every year, really, including our children who have their education healthcare plans. That was 4% last year nationally. That's now up to 4.3%. And if you think about boys versus girls as well, SEND is still more prevalent with boys than girls, but that gap is narrowing a little bit. So yeah, there is an increase in identification of SEND from schools, judging by the census data. And I think there's lots of different reasons for this. I could talk quite a lot actually about the different reasons for this if you'd like me to. I think in particular, and from my own experience in schools, I've seen a rise particularly around communication and language needs and social, emotional, mental health needs. And actually that's reflected in the data as well. That's reflected in the census data. So if you think about the SEND code of practice for England, you've got your four areas of learning. So you've got communication and language, learning and development, cognition and learning, your social, emotional, mental health, and then your sensory and physical. And CNL, the communication and language, and your SEMH, I just feel at the moment, are the ones that are on the rise, definitely. And what are the reasons for this? I think we do talk about COVID a lot. I think COVID has had a huge impact on how pupils are accessing their learning in mainstream classes and barriers to their learning, which is then presenting as SEND within the classroom. But I think there are a number of other reasons as well, including actually as professionals, SEND is higher on our agenda now than it used to be. And I think we are better as a profession now at identifying and understanding different SEND needs.
Yeah, I was going to say, I get the feeling that it's not that there are suddenly more students that have these needs. It's just that mm-hmm. we're better at yeah. spotting them now. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, I love the stat about boys and girls and girls catching up in some regards. But is there a particular SEND issue that boys kind of present with compared to girls, or is there no difference?
I know looking at ADHD, for example, boys are three times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD than girls because of the way that boys are more likely to present with ADHD in a classroom environment. Now, I'm always really careful when I talk about kind of the boy-girl divide or the different group divide, because the nature of SEND and the nature of identifying SEND is that pupil-centered approach. And I think we don't want to be too quick to kind of go, oh, well, all boys present like this, which is easier to identify, or all girls present like this, and that's a lot harder in a classroom to identify. But I think it is something to consider, I think, from some professionals and from parents about maybe the way that different groups or different genders present, really, with the set of needs. So,
I guess the reason I asked that was because my experience in the classroom was that, particularly with girls, the biggest issue, and obviously I'm not a SENCO, but the biggest issue I was presented with was anxiety issues with girls, particularly, and ADHD with boys. They were the very clear kind of categories that I came across. I'm sure the SENCO would have seen a different pattern, but
I think I probably would have said the same, actually. And I'm guessing it's because it's the more outwardly obvious need. If they are of the hyperactive type of ADHD, and therefore it's more obvious, they're more fidgety, the sort of thing that you are more likely to notice as a teacher, whereas inattentive, depending on how they mask it, if they're just zoning out, we'll spot that. We're busy having this at the moment. We're on the pathway to getting our daughter a diagnosis, and she and the SENCO was very upfront with us, quite rightly, and said, we're going to really struggle to give you any evidence towards a diagnosis because she's also got a bit of anxiety. She would never raise her head above the parapet or misbehave or anything. So perfect behavior record.
Yeah.
She's good. She's quite a bright kid, so she catches up with the work. She doesn't have any issues, because if she zones out, she'll then go, oh no, and then get her friends to catch her up. And so it's, I think, going to be quite challenging to get her a diagnosis based on what they see in school,
because
she fits it really, really well.
And based on the process as well of referral, because actually your first step of referral is, and some GPs will refer, but more often than not now, they are saying actually the referral has to come from school, and they have to be presenting with the symptoms of inattentivity, hyperactivity, all of that sort of thing across two different settings. And actually, quite often, as you said, sometimes with our girls, the understanding possibly of sometimes medical professionals even, and sometimes the teachers in the classroom, the understanding of actually she may have ADD or ADHD, but be presenting very differently. So just because she's not calling out and creating within a classroom, actually, is she drifting off? Is she daydreaming regularly? Does she struggle with her focus? And I think it's, again, around the education as well of our professionals and parents as well, and medical professionals, to understand actually how ADHD can present differently. But also as well, I think, recognising that a lot of the symptoms and the traits that we talk about when we talk about ADHD can be associated with other things as well. So very recently I read an article about sleep breathing disorder, and actually how a lot of sleep breathing disorder traits are similar to ADHD traits as well, and sleep apnea, and a lot of the things like such as lack of focus, daydreaming, drifting off, struggling with emotions, actually can be linked sometimes to sleep irregularities. And I think that's why as well it's about, and this is something that I think they do look for in that diagnosis, is that extended period of time. So have these traits been happening for, you know, a period of 6 months or longer, really? So it's not just a developmental stage, or it's not just maybe something, a temporary kind of something around anxiety or something that's happened, which is affecting their kind of them temporarily. Actually, it's looking at the bigger picture for that child.
That's interesting, but it makes total sense, because I know that the delayed onset sleep thing is very, very common in people with ADHD. I have it, my daughter has it, I've always struggled to get to sleep. So it makes sense that that would then have an impact on symptoms and things and look very similar. Interesting.
One of the questions for later, but I'll do it now, is to do with, she's an 18-year-old lass, and she's ridiculously clever. But she struggles with ADHD, and it presents in a lack of focus, I guess. So in a long exam, A-level exam, which is coming up in the summer, despite having all the intelligence, it's just that ability to focus the whole way through a two and a half hour exam, which she doesn't have. Now, because she doesn't present in I'm using the typical ADHD way, which some people might think of as a hyperactive outward. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. She won't get extra time. So therefore it's a case of, well, you have this issue, you're just gonna have to deal with it. It's tough, even though she's to maintain focus. And that would appear to be the answer that she's getting from both the exams office and from the Senko, saying, we can't help you here. We can't give you any extra time, even though we know what the problem is.
And has she got a formal diagnosis of ADHD?
I believe she has, yeah, but it was diagnosed privately. She's now over 18, so it's diagnosed outside of school. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, I believe that, there is no extra time being allowed, despite the clear diagnosis.
Okay. So usually with a diagnosis, you can have extra time if the school consider it actually a normal, she won't be at school if she's 18, as if the institution deem it to be a normal way of working for her. So actually, if she's got a formal diagnosis there, she can refer back to the Equalities Act and say, actually, this is a reasonable adjustment that needs to be made in order for me to be able to access my exams without disadvantage, really. And it's about if she has additional time, it's about a question of the integrity of the assessment, really. Is it going to impact the integrity of that assessment, her having additional time? And that's a question, really, that I suppose she should be taking back to the Senko and to the exams officer. Now, often, very often, with ADHD and with access arrangements, we think, right, additional time, 25% additional time, this will be really good for us and this will support us. But actually, more often than not, for somebody with ADHD, actually, that can not necessarily help having the additional time, because it's a longer period of time for you to have to focus. It's a longer period of time for you to kind of be anxious and worried. And actually, often rest breaks are much, much better for somebody with ADHD. What I would be suggesting to this young lady is that she be saying, actually, I really do need timed rest breaks, supervised rest breaks, because often that can be, if the institute is saying no, definitely not to 25% extra time, I think she should still pursue that. She should be still asking questions around that and the justification for it, particularly if she has got a formal diagnosis. But she should also be saying, actually, I really struggle with my focus. This has been something that is having a significant impact and a prolonged impact on my learning. And I'm assuming for other aspects of her learning, other aspects of her accessing the course, she must be having some sort of adjustments made to help her with manage that focus and manage that ability to digest the information that is being presented to her. So, yeah, I really would say look at rest breaks as well as an option there too.
Yeah,
the thing that was mentioned to me, because I had this conversation with school about our daughter's in year 10 as we record this, so we've got a couple of years to work our way up to the actual exams. And what she said about access arrangements was to bear in mind that often if they get extra time or rest breaks or anything along those lines, they're often doing that in a separate environment to the main exam hall, usually with the students who have a scribe or use a computer. Mm-hmm. And so you've got and people talking and so
reader.
On.
Yeah,
and so... Mm-hmm. If you're, if distraction is an issue for you, that's worth bearing in mind as well, because it's no use fighting for getting extra time or whatever to just be then sat in a room where there's people tapping pens and clicking things and you just can't concentrate, because that's the thing that I hadn't twigged. We'd 15 years as a teacher and I'd done all the training and we'd learned about the hyperactive kind of boy thing for ADHD. Yeah. And then someone had explained it a little bit better and explained the fact that we struggle to focus, to filter out sounds and things. So it's just there's all the stuff going on and your brain can't decide which things are important and which things are not important, and we don't need to listen to those. Mm-hmm. And having since realized that I have ADHD and it just presents really differently, that now makes much more sense to me. And I know she finds in a classroom, if it's a noisy environment, or worse, if it's a test and everyone's silent, but there's clicky pens or tappy feet or something, she really struggles with that. So I don't know whether it's much better in an example with 100 other students clicking things, but I thought that was an interesting, I wouldn't have thought that that was going to be an issue when asking for extra time or any extra
access. And I think it depends really as well how the school set up the access arrangements, because certainly when I was a Senko doing the access arrangements a couple of years ago, actually we didn't have, it wasn't the exam hall or one other room. It was the exam hall, or there was a room for computer readers, then there was a room for separate invigilation. So it would depend on the, I think we had possibly three other different rooms as well as the main hall. But again, it really depends on space within the schools, staffing within the school and things like that, and what would constitute kind of a reasonable adjustment within the context of that school, really. But that's, yeah, that's probably a conversation that's worth having with the school. Like, is there any opportunity for separate invigilation, but not in an environment where you've got a read, because actually they shouldn't, if there is somebody with a reader, they shouldn't really have anybody else in the room with them anyway, or that's likely to disturb other people doing the exam. So yeah, that's fair. And also, actually, similarly, we've had children who have had rest breaks who have been in the main hall because they didn't want to they didn't want to kind of be seen as different, but they knew they needed that rest break. And we've just kind of sat them at the very back of the hall, close to the door. And then there's just been somebody who's been supervising them a little bit more closely. And then when they need to, they can just slip out the back and have that supervisor.
So, all sense.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but also at the time where resources are diminishing almost by the week, it's a difficult conversation to have. It's an easy conversation to have, but difficult for the school to deliver on, because it's resources at the end of the day.
Part of the reason we do these podcasts is so that parents know what questions to ask, they know what the options are, they know what the factors are to consider. So I think that's been really helpful. I know it's been really helpful for me to figure out, you know, what's worth asking for, what questions to ask at school. So
and I think similar, like, kind of, I suppose, as I was saying at the start, my experience of a Senko will be based around some schools, but not every single school. And schools are very different, and the resources that they have are very different. The space they have available is very different. So, like, I could recommend that this might be happening or this might be happening, but it won't necessarily be able to be happening in every school. So, but it's certainly worth the conversation, I think, sometimes, with an understanding maybe from parents that sometimes it can't always, we can't accommodate everything, so it's not, so
quick thing I was just thinking about, an EHCP, how long does it take to formalize from the first conversation about that we think this might be a concern to actually having an EHCP produced?
Okay, so the official guidelines for an EHCP are 20 weeks, but that is from the date that it is submitted. The application is submitted from the school to the date when the EHCP is supposed, the final draft of the EHCP is supposed to have been created. But what you have to think about with an EHCP is all of the pre-conversations and the evidence gathering that needs to happen before an application can be submitted by a school. Sometimes if a parent, parents obviously can do the application for an EHCP as well. And sometimes when parents do that application, it can reduce sometimes the amount of evidence that's needed in the initial part. But as a Senko who has done many, many EHCP applications in their time, you do need to gather an awful lot of evidence to demonstrate the complexity of the need. And that is your assess, plan, do, review cycles. So that's just, you're basically showing how school have already tried to put adjustments in place, what has been the impact of that, why have they not been successful, or why have they been successful but require a significant amount more resource from the school in order for that success. And that process really is a minimum of 2 terms to make sure you've got all of that evidence that the school have actually put evidence in place. And it's got to include, and this is a real stinger, actually it doesn't have to include, but they often like it to include, external agency involvement. So you have to have had, usually you've had to have had some sort of educational psychologist or speech and language therapist or somebody external who is supporting, because the complexity of the need warrants that. And as we know, at this moment in time, EPs, educational psychologists, are very, very hard to come by. And actually, that can sometimes put a real delay on the initial application for an EHCP. But saying that, there have been times when I've gone to local authorities, it's not a statutory requirement to have EP involvement before an application for an EP goes in. I think local authorities just prefer you to have done that and have gone through that approach. But there have been times when I've gone, you know what, the EP is not available, because we haven't got the resources for that. But this is a case that we need to look at, we need to be prioritising. And then once the application has gone in, if after first panel, it's then agreed that they are going to do a statutory assessment for an EHCP, an educational psychologist is then involved at that stage and has to be legally involved at that stage. So,
wow. And that's the reason why I'm saying those are the busiest people in the entire school.
I was going to say, is it just a resources thing? The reason it's so difficult to get your child the support that you know would be useful for them, because it's, from a parent point of view, it feels like, well, I know what's wrong with my child. I know what things I think would, certainly as a teacher with experience and a parent, I know what things would be useful for her in the classroom. Can we not just do the things? They're not people intensive. They just make sure teachers know this stuff. And and yet there are 27,000 hoops to jump through, and it's it just feels like a bit of a marathon. And is that just a resources thing? Is there anything else that's making it so complicated?
What, in terms of the EHCP application process and getting an EHCP? I would say the primary sticking point with that is resourcing, and is like local authority budgets as well. Around, obviously, EHCPs more often than not come with additional funding into schools just to ensure that whatever is detailed, because it's a legal document, whatever is detailed on that EHCP needs to be put in place by school. It's a requirement, and the school more often than not will need additional funding in order to make sure that provision can be put in place effectively. So there's the issue around funding sometimes, which is really difficult, because local authorities can have to be really, really thorough with their assessment of it to make sure that the funding is being really effectively allocated, I suppose is the best way to put it. But I also think it's very dependent on your level of SEND experience and understanding within a school as well. I think in order to be a SENCO, you don't necessarily have to have done a SEND qualification straight away. You have to have done it within 3 years of starting your SEND, being in the SEND position. Now, for someone like me who's quite an experienced SENCO, I know pretty quickly what evidence I need, what I need to put in that application, what conversations I need to be having with the pupil, what conversations I need to be having with parents. So the information gathering stage, I can do it relatively quickly. But I'm sure if you had asked me many years ago on my first EHCP application, that process would have been a little bit longer, because I would have had to myself had to go had different conversations with teachers, make sure I've got the right information. Once you've done the application, if all of the evidence isn't there, and first panel think, actually, you know what, we've not got enough parent voice here, or we haven't got enough evidence of that undue review from the school, then it will get rejected at first panel, and then you almost have to either appeal or start the process again. So I think primarily I would say it is around resourcing, but I also think there's an element of the understanding and experience of SEND within a school. And if you've got a school which has a lot of experience around SEND and maybe has pupils with complex needs and with high levels of SEND issues, I think you're going to have possibly an easier time with maybe getting the speed behind the EHCP that you need. I hope that makes sense.
I guess the reason I ask that is because we do get a lot of parents with children heading towards exams saying, this is an issue. We need to get diagnosed. We need to get an EHCP. And, I think the message is you just got to start probably no later than the start of year 10.
Start as soon as humanly possible,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I think as well, I think for with access arrangements and with examinations, an EHCP can be helpful because with you don't need to do the additional psychometric tests for your access arrangements if you've got your EHCP already. If you can show, right, normal way of working is additional time, separate invigilation and all of that, and it's detailed on their EHCP, all the school have to do is produce what's called a Form 9 just to show this is a normal way of working. But if a child doesn't have an EHCP, but we know actually they probably are at that level, have got a complex need that's going to impact them, that won't stop them having access arrangements. It's just the school will have to go around it in a slightly different way. So the school will complete what's the Form 8. I'm talking, I'm using a few technical terms here, so sorry.
Useful, so yeah.
So it's what's called a Form 8. And in part one of the Form 8, the SENCO is responsible for this, and SENCO has to detail, with input from teachers, pastoral leads and parents where appropriate, what is the history of difficulties of that child, what's the history of their difficulties, and what are their current difficulties, and what current provision is in place to support that child. And if, for example, you say, do you know what, in class we always need to give this child a little bit of extra time in order to process what we're saying or in order to complete a task, if in mock exams we make sure we give him 25% extra time, actually that plus evidence from the psychometric tests, if it shows a standardized score of less than 85, will be enough to warrant additional time or some certain access arrangements. But access arrangements are a whole thing that I can talk to you about for a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
No, so basically, I think the take home from that is you don't need to have the EHCP in order to get the access arrangements. So I wouldn't necessarily, as a parent, I wouldn't necessarily worry too much about, oh my goodness, they've got the EHCP paperwork or they haven't at that stage.
Right. We probably need to make sure we ask the actual questions because I have lots of questions that I want to just throw in, which is probably unhelpful. So what specific advice would you give to a child who's dyslexic and has audio and visual processing disorder about how to revise effectively for GCSEs? So they've said the processing disorders are proving more disruptive to revision than the dyslexia because the usual techniques just don't work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm actually working at the moment with a pupil who is dyslexic and doing some, she's on a GCSE course at the moment. There's loads of guidance around dyslexia and support for dyslexia. First thing, as I would say, caveat for everything, make sure you come at it from a child-centred or young person-centred point of view. So the first thing that I would do is, obviously, you can look at dyslexia guidance. You can think, right, these are really good dyslexia-friendly strategies, but not everything is going to work for everyone. So first thing that I would do, and this is what I always do, actually, when I start in a new place as a SENCO, I would have kind of a learning interview with the pupils. And actually, I know sometimes it's your own child. It might sound a bit formal to have a learning interview with your own child. But it is actually really useful to go kind of, right, when do you feel like you're really being productive with your learning? When are you really remembering things well? What strategies work for you? What strategies really don't work for you? And as a parent, sometimes just having that conversation with your child really gives you a clear understanding of what's going to work for them and what isn't. For a child with dyslexia, with processing difficulties, I think the thing to a really key thing to try to focus on is like that multi-sensory learning approach. So don't rely on one method of learning, I would say. So for example, some pupils learn really well from picking up the textbook, reading it and absorbing it. I could never learn like that. I had a friend who did that, just picked up a textbook, read it and understood it and remembered it. I was never like that. And some pupils are able to see that, some pupils aren't. But it's about mixing that up a little bit, I think, if you've got processing difficulties. So yes, do a bit of reading, but also maybe think about your mind mapping. Think about how you're presenting it visually to help you process and remember things. Also looking at kind of auditory learning as well, like videos that are accessible to you, interactive engagement. And sometimes just coming at it from a slightly different, I think I feel like I'm rambling a little bit. Apologies if I am.
It's making perfect sense. I love it. Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes coming at it from a little bit of a slightly different point of view, which is a slightly different way of learning. Now I'm going to give an example here, which might come across as a bit strange, but
they're used to us, don't worry.
when I was revising for my GCSEs, I actually, one of the things that I was told and my parents had allowed me to do when my GCSEs were finished was I could redecorate my room, which meant that I could write all of my GCSE notes on my wallpaper in my bedroom. Now some people might think, oh my goodness, you'd never switch off, like how would you be able to even focus, but actually for me it was quite novel, so I was actually quite engaged to do it. I could make it into mind maps, I could make it quite visual, and it meant there was lots of opportunities for just incidental learning. So I'd be getting up in the morning, I'd be getting changed, and actually while I was doing that I'd be reading a mind map about one of my science subjects. So it's about, I think, coming at it from, it's about different approaches to learning and also time blocking, and make sure that you're giving yourself time to understand and review the information that's in front of you and blocking that information appropriately. It's not an easy question to answer that one.
No, and we appreciate that. I loved that. I know that certainly we used to occasionally in lessons, particularly with my lower sets who were less engaged and less confident, we'd do lessons where they could just write on the table with whiteboard marker because it cleans off. And they were like, what? We're allowed to write on the table. And they loved it. You can get magic whiteboard paper, which comes on sheets like cling film, which static clings to the wall. And you can use that to write on with a whiteboard marker if you don't want your teen writing on the wallpaper or the wall. So totally works as an example, and I love that. It also occurred to me that you can't tell me off for talking to myself while I work anymore, because that's just me being an auditory processor at the same time. I'm using multi, what's it?
But at the same time, when we first came across this, she talks to herself all the time. The diagnosis was there. I just thought it was kind of really annoying because, as we've explained before, being the sort of like obedient husband, if she talks, I have to listen. But it turns out she's having a conversation with herself and not actually saying anything.
Well, so I'm self-employed now. It's a staff meeting. That's how I explain it. Yeah.
And I'm assuming as well for this pupil with processing difficulties that the conversation around access arrangements and additional time has already been had, and she had, because that would be a very prime example of additional time requirement.
I have a follow-up question actually from the person. I think unless you've my son was assessed and has been allocated a reader for his exams but has never actually been given one. School have said he must just ask the invigilator to read a question. Is this right? He feels uncomfortable doing this.
No, that's absolutely not right.
there's no polite answers. That's nonsense.
So I think this is actually really important. And again, it's very easy for me to say when I'm not in that school and I don't understand the resource. And I don't, what I don't want to do is set any schools up and say, oh my goodness, that's awful practice. But a reader really should be somebody that child knows pretty well and is quite comfortable with and has some sort. I mean, I'm not saying that they necessarily have to be their teacher or have a really good relationship, but needs to be confident enough to go into an exam and work with. So there needs to have been definitely some sort of maybe supporting class with that person for that child, so they understand. So they both, and that's a two-way thing. So that pupil understands how that reader will work and how the reader understands how the pupil will work and what the best way to navigate that situation is. The invigilator has a completely separate role in examinations and shouldn't really be being asked to be a reader as well as an invigilator.
Very, very diplomatic answer. Yes. But I think we all read between the lines there.
Yes. Excellent. Fabulous.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. In which case, I'm moving on. And I'm going to jump on this one because it's another ADHD kind of question. Although she's been able to cope and do well in school, she really has to work hard and makes loads of silly mistakes, which frustrates her because all the tips and tricks that all the teachers give don't work for her. So are there any tried and tested tips and tricks that other ADHD students use? I think in terms of making sure that it's not the silly mistakes that you don't flip past stuff.
Yeah, and I wonder if, and this, it might be worth it. Again, you know, I spoke about having that learning conversation, that learning interview with your child. It'd be worth exploring if she's ever had any work around self-editing of her work or time to go back and check on her work, because that is a really key thing, which actually a lot, not just ADHD pupils or pupils who struggle with making mistakes, actually all pupils it benefits, but particularly those who, you know, sometimes may lose focus, may rush a little bit, may not necessarily be able to go back. And it comes back to that, giving them rest breaks and giving them time to go back and just review what they have written, and making sure that teachers are allowing that to happen in the classroom as well, and making sure that they're aware. So I think that would be that really key. And I mean, that may well be one of the tips or tricks that we're talking about that hasn't worked. But I think if she feels, actually, do you know what? It's okay for me to make a few mistakes here because I've got time to just go back over this and review it and reflect on it and edit it, then she might feel a bit more comfortable really with that.
But that comes back to the extra time required in the exam. So it's a conversation.
And making it a normal way of working as well. I always reread any email before I send it, any text message, any anything, because that's what I've learned to do to get past any of those daft mistakes that slip through. But it has to be a thing that you just do. And you have to build that into your way of working, don't you?
I think sometimes as well, when pupils and when young people kind of have that diagnosis, they sometimes feel a bit like, oh my goodness, this must be because of my diagnosis. And actually, also just having those conversations around that young person of, do you know what, everybody makes mistakes sometimes. And actually, it's just about making sure you've got the strategies to manage that on your day to day to help. Because actually, yeah, you might be more inclined maybe to rush things, be a little bit more impulsive and possibly slip with it with certain aspects of a work. But as you said, don't we all pre-freeze an email before we send it out? Or don't we, you know, a lot of the time we do that as a strategy anyway. So that's just making sure she understands it's not an unusual thing to do.
There's a follow-up question from that. What are the opinions on medication for revision and exams only? In terms of ADHD, sorry.
Yeah. This is quite, obviously, I'm not a medical professional, so it's difficult for me to really understand and comment too much on this. But I know often, and I think it depends on what type of medication you're on, but often the medication you need to have had a build-up of the medication in order for it to work. So sometimes with some types of medication, just putting a child on that medication for a short period of time or for a specific purpose actually can not be particularly productive or useful. But what I would advise about that is just go back and have that conversation with the doctor, the paediatrician, and just say, actually, would this work? Because I think it's very dependent on the type of medication that you have as well around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just I'm throwing in a follow-up question because I know for me, I was diagnosed with combined type, with hyperactive and inattentive, and I was very surprised by that because I'm not obviously hyperactive. I'm quite content to sit still for long periods of time, which confuses Paul because he can't. But I fidget, I talk with my hands. I have to be fidgeting nowadays with, it's either my phone or crochet, or I'm doing something on my computer. That's where my hyperactivity tends to be outward. And in lessons, that is something that as a teacher, I know when a child comes in with a fidget spinner, you're just like, oh, please, no. And I know that I certainly, I wouldn't have wanted to sit there with something really obvious and visible. Look at me, I'm different, I'm allowed this thing, because that's not the kind of person I am. And that's something that puts off a lot of students. And I know that if I'm not fidgeting, I really struggle to concentrate. So are there any things that you've found that have worked for students that you could, just like a pencil or a
blue tack?
Blue tack, yes. Or we used to make little cubes out of it. Yeah, I'm remembering now.
I think you're absolutely right. I think I've kind of moved away from the term fidget toy to concentration aid, actually, because I think particularly in a primary classroom, if you talk about a fidget toy, suddenly everybody wants a fidget toy. Suddenly everybody needs a fidget toy and able to concentrate. But actually, again, if you're teaching the class about differences and neurodiversity and things like that, and understanding actually some people need concentration aids in order to help them focus in their learning, you don't all need concentration as much as that helps. But I absolutely understand what you're saying, because actually sometimes people don't want to be sat there with a very obvious fidget spinner that they're spinning, or the classic one actually was the wobble cushion. I think wobble cushion is quite primary, and I've had reports, I've had like recommendations through actually before for wobble cushions for secondary pupils, and I just said to me, please don't make me carry a wobble cushion around school. which just,
what is it?
It's just, it's a cushion that you sit on, which you can, it's kind of, it regulates a little bit. You can wobble around on it, and it's like kind of
sounds like a beach ball thing for not called beach
similar,
balls, are they?
Like you know what I mean? A yoga ball. Type.
Yes.
But not. But
when you're having a baby, it's that kind of stuff.
Or sometimes, again, when you're in a primary classroom, it's much easier to actually accommodate this than in a secondary setting. Kind of under the table, having like little pedalo thing under the table, so you can constantly be pedaling with your feet, but actually presenting quite calm on top. But to be perfectly honest, one of the most successful things that I've found for a concentration aid is blue tack, because you can squeeze it, you can mold it, it doesn't make a noise, and actually it's very subtle, and you don't have others in a class going, oh, I want that toy that you've got, oh, can I have a little go on it? Actually, not usually, 9 times out of 10 people bothered. So that would be my probably novice tip for
that. I love it.
I like that. That's something that I don't think she has that she takes to school. I think we both have a fidget ring, which is just a really subtle little, you can just spin it or move things around on it, and it just gives you something that you can do without it being obvious that that's what you need to do. Blue tack, I like the idea of that. Get her a
Play-Doh, because it smells nicer in my CBT. Any thoughts on whether CBT helps with, we're still talking about ADHD in terms of this particular student. Any thoughts on that?
I've not actually had any experience of CBT for specifically just for ADHD. I've worked in schools where they've implemented some CBT based programs, which has helped an awful lot with anxiety, actually. Now, if there is, often you'll find sometimes pupils with, who have got that neurodiversity do have anxiety because of, I suppose, the implications of the neurodiversity within the mainstream school. But the CBT has really helped with that. But in terms of, do they mean in terms of supporting like the symptoms of ADHD, like hyperactivity or
I may still be talking about the silly mistakes and just trying to overcome or find strategies to overcome those possibly.
Yeah, because my understanding is CBT is more about supporting emotional dysregulation.
And it's about kind of adjusting your thinking to focus more on positive thoughts, I think. So whether that would necessarily help, I probably wouldn't be able to comment that much on that, whether it would be able to help with that, but I've not experienced it used for that before.
And then as a quick separate follow-up, in terms of, I can vouch for ADHD, your brain just does not shut up. That's my main issue. That's the difference that I notice with medication, is I can actually think one thought at a time, which is magical. Having tried all of the, you know, the mindfulness and the meditation and so on, that's very challenging when your brain's busy going blah 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 blah, blah, blah at you. Are there any exercises, anything that you've found that works in terms of calming? Is it, you know, brown noise, for example, white noise, something along those lines, or anything that you found effective with students and just quietening the brain in a non-medicinal fashion?
Two things that I found really have helped, actually. But again, my caveat, pupil-centered, what works for one pupil won't work for another pupil. Mindful drawing, actually, because it's keeping your hands busy, or colouring, because it's keeping your hands busy, it's giving you a focus as well. Because sometimes if you're told to kind of just stop and think and meditate, like you said, if your brain is going 10 to the dozen, it's really hard for you to then try and do that. But if you've got a focus for it, then you can. So that was one. And the other one that's worked quite well from experience was, and this isn't jumping on your Play-Doh comment ball, but actually, like, create, like, again, it's a creative thing, but play, like, not Play-Doh, but play. So using play to create something. And it's just, again, about settling the brain and giving the brain a little bit of a focus. But you know what you were saying there about white noise and brown noise and things, it is sometimes pupils respond and young people respond differently to different sensory things. So it might, again, it's worth a conversation of, do you find like white noise helps you just calm your thoughts down? And sometimes certain smells can actually be very be quite reassuring for pupils and help to just calm them a little bit. So it's worth thinking about, like sensory things and some of that mindfulness, but mindfulness with a bit of a focus, something like you've got the brain to focus on. Makes sense.
I like that, yeah.
Now, fully aware that we said about half an hour, we're about 45 minutes already. Are you okay to carry on? Is that?
Yeah, I'm fine. Fine, right. Till about 2 o'clock.
I'll try and, so there's one here. I'd like to know how to help a child with ASD to manage exam stress.
So that whole being out of routine and so on, I'm guessing, is the biggest part.
Yeah, definitely. Lots and lots of preparation. I would say this for any child, but particularly a pupil with ASD, making sure that the school have done all of the stuff that they need to do around transition. So for that child will need to know in the morning what room is he or she going to be in. Who is going to be supporting? Who's going to be in that room that they may know? And if they're looking at, like an exam invigilator or separate accommodation, please make sure that it is somebody that child knows and has a relationship with and understands their ASC. Unless the child has specifically said, no, I want somebody completely different who I don't know at all. But I would really say that would be important. So the child is aware, what room am I going to be in? Who am I going to be with? What are my papers going to look like even? You might actually just look, this is what, and the school will do this through mock exams and things like that. But for a child with ASD, they will need that twice, three times over to help them manage and understand that process. A visual timetable as well for the days. So on the days when that pupil has got exams, what is his day going to look like or her day going to look like, and how is that different from their usual daily routine? So will they still be getting up at the same time? Will they still be wearing the same clothes? So there'll be some things which will be consistent, which you can reassure them of, and then there'll be some things which are very different, and it's about helping them manage that and understanding the differences in their routine. But absolutely, preparation is key, I think, with that, in order to help manage that. And getting plenty, working collaboratively with the school to get plenty of information as well about what is the day going to look like for those pupils. What do you want me to do in the morning to help prepare for him or her coming into school? And what can you tell me about the environment and how the environments can be different?
I mean, there is a reason that we say for all students, treat mocks as a dress rehearsal, because it's about figuring out what it's going to look like, what works, what doesn't work, you know, where do we need a little bit of extra focus, how's it going to feel, that kind of thing. But yeah, I can imagine that's far more drastic. Yeah. If you're, I must have my routine kind of a, right. And then I'm going to jump ahead to, I have a 14-year-old suffering with anxiety. He's unable to go into a lot of lessons, but the school's labelling him as a school refuser that doesn't want to do things. He's seeing a psychologist that's confirmed the anxiety, but school still doesn't want to help. Is this a common problem at private schools? And do we have any rights for reasonable requests?
Okay, so I've not worked in a private school before, so I can't comment on that. But I know that there is definitely a shift in the last few years, moving away from the term school refusal into emotion-based school avoidance. Because actually, a lot of school refusal is suggesting that there's some element of control there as a child, whereas an emotion-based school avoidance is saying, actually, do you know what? This child can't do it. And I think it just sounds a little bit like possibly the culture of that school hasn't yet caught up with the idea of, actually, this is not necessarily a choice that the child is making. The child clearly, and there's obviously a lot of external agency involvement there, isn't there, from the school? There's professionals involved. So I think there needs to be a conversation with the school about, actually, this is not school refusal, this is emotion-based school avoidance. And the school need to start thinking about a, so is he attending school at all? He's attending but not all lessons.
It sounds like, yeah, he's unable to go into a lot of lessons.
So really what I would be doing as a SENCO in that position is be speaking to the child if the child will speak to me, to kind of get a bit of his voice about what it is around those lessons, speaking to the teachers of the lessons that he is accessing and saying, what is he enjoying about your lessons and why is he accessing them? And speaking to the teachers of the lessons that he's not accessing to see if they've got any understanding of why he is struggling to access those lessons. The fact that he's getting into school and accessing some is a real positive. And that means that there is things there that the school can be working on, definitely. And what you don't want to do is, and I've seen this happen, is just have a pupil that then slips and slips and slips because reasonable adjustments aren't put in place soon enough, and actually they end up really struggling accessing school at all. So yes, I think really a conversation around the fact that he is getting support for managing his anxiety around school, he is accessing some lessons and he's getting into some lessons, but there is something that he's obviously clearly struggling with. And actually, can we just find out and get a bit more information around why is he not accessing those lessons and what as a school and as parents we can do to support him getting into lessons? That would be.
I like that slight change of naming convention because it makes a lot of sense. I would say I'm an emotionally based dentist avoider because it makes me so very anxious and it stresses me out. It's not that I'm just going, oh, I can't be bothered. Mm-hmm. I can be in some beginnings of pain and still be not wanting to go because I know how it affects me. And it's a very different kind of way of communicating it, isn't it? And I would imagine I'd be doing the same. I'd be asking, what is the difference? You know, is it that you've got a teacher who make students read out loud or answer questions on the spot or something along those lines, because we hear about this from all sorts of different places nowadays, and as ex-teachers we're kind of going, no, you can't do that, but it's very difficult when you've got a teacher in a classroom. They're used to their autonomy. That the first few years there's very rarely anyone who comes in to watch you, and when they do you normally know about it, so you've got time to put on a good show. And so you can slip into some bad habits that really don't support students, particularly neurodiverse students.
Which
kind of brings me to, I think, the final official goal.
We're going to the top ones. Well, we've got a lad here who's got his slow processing, recently tested and assessed. He's being given 25% extra time. Are there any other considerations to his approach in preparing for GCSEs? Now he's in year 11 following the diagnosis.
That diagnosis of
slow process.
Yeah. And he's got additional time. So I would say in the way that he's going to take his in the way he's going to approach his exam paper, approach his revision in the same way. So he's got 25% additional time. So if he's doing practice papers, practice with 25% additional time. That sounds probably quite obvious. I would also, quite similar to the way to the question I answered before about looking at the way that he's revising and what revision strategies are going to work for him and help him process and understand it more. So time blocking is always a really good thing to do. If you do not block, right, all Wednesday morning from 9 a.m. to 12 a.m, I'm going to revise all of my English. Like, that isn't going to work for him. He would need to break it down more, I would say, into shorter periods of time and have a focus. So actually, I'm going to revise this for half an hour. And at the end of this half an hour, this is what I want to have remembered. This is what I want, the sort of questions I want to be able to answer. And again, as much as possible, try and, if it works for him, vary the way that he's doing his revision. So don't just stick to, right, I'm going to look through my books and make notes, or don't just stick to, right, I'll go on BBC Bite Size and do it that way. Try and do a little bit of everything in order to help his processing of information in different ways, and help his kind of his memory around that. So that's what I would say is really key. And just for him to bear in mind, actually, you've got 25% extra time, and it is okay to slow down, reread, and make sure you understand the information that you are taking in, and make sure that you can articulate that well when you are then your input. Make sure your input is good, make sure your understanding is good, and then when your output, make sure your output as well is clear and concise.
And then I think I'm probably wrap things up with, I'm paraphrasing the final question, but if you could, if there was a national teacher training day declared, every teacher has to participate in this training day, it's going to be centrally organized, someone is going to train teachers on, what things would you like teachers to know more about or be better trained on that would make life easier for pupils with special educational needs in their classroom?
Wow, what a question. What would it be? I would say relationships. Loads of teachers are really, really good at this. So I don't think it's national, I don't think it's necessarily a big gap, but I think the understanding of relationships and how they support and inform your practice, particularly for your SEND pupils, is really important. We did I did some training recently, emotion coaching training, and it's about looking and analyzing the behaviors of your pupils when they're in the class. And that might be your pupils who are outwardly displaying quite challenging or disruptive behaviors, but it could also be actually those people who are passive, who are not always as engaged in the learning as they need to be. And it's about, I think the training that I would ask teachers to do is start to think about, what is that behavior telling us? Because behavior is communication, and I think that's a really important message for all of our teachers and all of the workforce to really understand. And I think sometimes it's a message that can be a little bit lost when you don't, if particularly in secondary, maybe you don't always see the same pupils throughout the whole day. You can struggle sometimes to develop those relationships with them. But yeah, I think that's a really fundamental part of good teaching and learning, and support for SEND pupils.
Yeah, I would imagine that helps with preempting a lot of issues as well, because you'll be able to see when students are starting to get dysregulated, overstimulated, any of those things. You start to recognize that, don't you, more?
Absolutely. And your approach to them will be different. If you understand that, your approach will be a little bit different. You will understand actually how you might need to speak to them about that. How it like for some teachers, it may be if a pupil is starting to show dysregulation in a class, sometimes some teachers may naturally just kind of in front of the class go, what's going on? You know, like, sit down, stop. But actually, it might be better just to go over and go, come on, what's going on? Tell me about this. Da, da, da. And yeah, I think it's about your approach to it. It just supports approach to teaching and to individual pupils.
Brilliant. Perfect
thank
time
you. Yeah,
to wrap
thank
up,
you
I think.
so much. That's been, I think, a whirlwind tour of all sorts of stuff, and hopefully that's given parents a lot of ammunition is the wrong word, but a lot of information. Because if you know what you're talking about, even when with the technical stuff, you know, the different forms and the processes that schools go through, if you know what those are as a parent, you can advocate for your child a lot better, and you can also give school the grace to do all the things and jump through all the hoops rather than being all, why haven't you done this yet? Because, you know, understanding that it does make a really big difference. So a huge thank you for taking the time to go into that with us and go into the detail that you did. I think that's going to really help a lot of people.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. I felt like I was maybe rambling a little bit.
Absolutely not. No, brilliant. Can I put in a play immediately, please, for a repeat? Because this is the topic that we get more questions about than any other. So if a bit further down the line, you don't mind coming back, I'm sure the questions will possibly be similar, but always with a slightly different angle. So thank you very, very much.
Yes. Yeah. Fabulous. All right. Thank you. All right.